question is that this House has considered the disclosure of information in pre-trial abuse of process hearings. Minister.
Thank you very much, Mr Chairman, and it's a pleasure to serve under your chairmanship. I'd also like to thank the Right Honourable Member for Chesham and Amersham for raising these important issues and acknowledge the hurt and anger of her constituent, how he feels as a result of what happened to him at school so many years ago. Sexual abuse by children, by those in positions of authority and power who abuse their position of trust, is a devastating crime. And although I can't imagine what Mr. Perry has been through, I commend him, like she has, for his courage in continuing to speak out about his experiences, with a view to contributing to the debate on how we can improve the criminal justice system for victims. I understand also what she says about her relationship with him, and I'm pleased that he has been able to contribute to the improvement and futures of those who have suffered like he has. And I'm very pleased for an opportunity today to discuss the concerns that the Honourable Member has raised about the disclosure of information in relation to pre-trial abuse hearings. The Right Honourable Member for Chesham and Amersham raised at the beginning the broader issues in relation to disclosure. We are, like her, concerned about the broad issue of disclosure. It is absolutely imperative that disclosure in a case is properly made. And as she rightly identified, the Attorney General published last year a review into disclosure and will be publishing further guidelines in due course. The Right Honourable Member referred in some detail to her constituent, Mr. Perry's case. And she will know it's not appropriate for me, as Solicitor General, to comment on decisions made by members of the independent judiciary in the two prosecutions of Peter Wright. I understand that the allegations that have been made about the conduct of those representing Peter Wright during the original criminal proceedings in 2003 have been considered by the police, as she mentioned, by the Bar Standards Board and the Solicitors Regulatory Authority, and those are the correct bodies to look at allegations of this nature. Also, in 2012, one of my predecessors as Solicitor General also personally considered whether to bring contempt proceedings arising out of what the judge was told in 2003, but he concluded that there was insufficient evidence to do so. I understand that the trial judge in the proceedings that led to Mr. Wright's conviction in 2013, as she mentioned, also considered the arguments that had been employed in the abuse of process application in 2003, but declined to lift the stay on proceedings. I am not aware of any adverse findings made by against any lawyers involved in the criminal proceedings arising out of the abuse at Caldecott School between 1959 and 1970. But none of this is in any way designed to diminish the profound effect that these crimes must have had on Mr. Perry's life, or to detract from our commitment as law officers superintending the prosecuting departments to promote best practice in the care that victims of sexual abuse receive from the criminal justice system. But the issues that Mr. Perry continues to raise have not been ignored, and they have received serious consideration in the past. As members will know, it is open to a defendant to argue that a prosecution is an abusive process. For example, because of the effective delay on the fairness of the trial, and that proceedings should therefore be stayed. This arises out of the overriding duty on courts to promote justice and to prevent injustice. The burden lies on the defendant to prove in these cases, on a balance of probabilities, that there has been an abuse and also that a fair trial is no longer possible. There is clear authority from the Court of Appeal that there is a strong public interest in the prosecution of crime and that ordering a stay of proceedings is absolutely a remedy of last resort, even where there has been a significant delay in bringing proceedings. So as the Honourable Member for Strangford pointed out, the bar for a stay is very high. Even when a judge imposes a stay on proceedings, the prosecution can apply to lift the stay in the future. and such an application as the Honourable Member, Right Honourable Member, mentioned was made in Mr. Perry's case in 2012. And whilst the judge declined the prosecution application to lift the stay of the 2003 proceedings, she did allow the fresh allegations against Peter Wright to be tried by a jury and also allowed details of the abuse that Mr. Perry suffered to be admitted as bad character evidence during the trial. As a result, the jury found Mr. Wright guilty of abusing five pupils during the 1960s, and he was sentenced to 8 years imprisonment. The Right Honourable Member for Chesham and Amersham makes some important observations about disclosure in the criminal justice system. And as Honourable Members will be aware, the recent review of disclosure was carried out by the Attorney General, and he has made recommendations to improve performance across the criminal justice system. In our criminal justice system, there is a statutory duty on prosecutors to disclose to the defence any material or information that may assist the defence or undermine the prosecution case. This duty applies to abusive process hearings as well as trials. There's also a residual duty on the prosecution at common law to disclose any information which would assist the accused in the preparation of the defence case. This duty applies from the outset in criminal proceedings and requires the disclosure of material which might enable an accused to make an early application to stay the proceedings as an abusive process. I'm very happy to
take. The Honourable Lady is quite properly setting out the duties on the prosecution entirely accurately and fairly. Does she agree with me that there is a duty, however, on all parties to ensure that what they submit does not in any way mislead the court, and that applies to the defence just as it does to the Crown?
The Honourable Member makes an important point that I was coming on to. There is no, it is absolutely right that no counsel or solicitor, counsel as an officer of the court with a primary duty to the court and not to his client or her client, must not mislead the court. But the disclosure of evidence is a different obligation on the defence. There is no corresponding legal duty on the defence to disclose information that is harmful to its case, because that is consistent with the fundamental principle that it is for the prosecution to prove its case and not for the defendant to prove his innocence. But as the Honourable Member for Cheltenham has rightly identified, whilst there is a very important legal duty on counsel, on barristers, who have themselves a professional code of conduct, which include the requirement to act ethically and with integrity at all times. And that includes a prohibition on knowingly or recklessly misleading anyone, including a court, and a positive duty to behave in a way that maintains public trust and confidence in the proper administration of justice. My right honourable friend mentioned that she may have, or her constituent may have, details of other cases where a court has been misled, and I would strongly encourage her to share those details with the CPS and the professional bodies who are responsible for barristers and solicitors if there is such evidence.
To the Minister and the way in which she is responding to this debate. She mentioned that it is important to maintain trust in the regulatory bodies. And wouldn't she agree with me that in light of the circumstances of this particular case, that trust has been shaken? And I will provide her with those details once they're provided to me by my constituents so that she can pass them on to the relevant authorities or look at them herself, because it is for her office that I believe my constituent wishes to have a response from.
I appreciate what she says, that her constituent feels that trust has been shaken in the criminal justice system, and that is, of course, of concern. I should reiterate that there have been, as far as I'm aware, no findings of any misconduct by the Bar Standards Board in relation to the case, but I would be very happy to receive any further information, as I'm sure they would, in relation to any further details that she can provide. I would just like to underline the additional safeguards that exist, both for defendants and victims, when a stay application is brought. There are a number of rules and regulations which ensure that the hearing should be conducted with due notice and in the interests of justice. So the 2015 criminal procedural rules set out a timetable that the defence and prosecution should adhere to when preparing for a hearing. For example, the defence application must be in writing and provided to the prosecution and court as soon as practicable, as soon as they become aware of grounds for applying. The application must include or identify all supporting material, specify all relevant events, and identify any witnesses the defendant wishes to call in support of the application. And the prosecution must do likewise within 14 days of receiving the application. And both parties must serve skeleton arguments on each other and the court in advance of the actual hearing so that everyone knows the issues to be determined at the hearing. Finally, I think it's important to identify the importance of victim care in cases of sexual abuse. And I think what Mr. Perry's experience does demonstrate is why it is so important that we continue to make victim care a priority in our criminal justice system. I'm very happy to give one.
I would agree with her that victims should have priority in our criminal justice system, and that is most important. She mentioned at the beginning of her response to this debate that she is working on new guidelines that would come out shortly. Could she perhaps give us a greater indication of when we can expect those new guidelines? And would there be any possibility of looking at the draft guidelines before they are finalised and then published?
Minister. Well, there was a review in relation to disclosure which has already taken place. Further guidance will be coming out in due course. I'm very happy to update the Right Honourable Member of any further details that we have of that and to take on board any points that she might like to make. We're not just, however, focusing on disclosure, although that is very important. The CPS has almost doubled the number of specialist prosecutors in their dedicated rape and serious sexual offence units and is working with the Ministry of Justice and the Home Office to revise the Victims Code to improve the support and care offered to victims. It's important to remember, of course, that these issues affect not just the Attorney General's office, but they are issues across departmentally, and we are working together with other departments on those. Debates on this area are an important contribution to the ongoing work and to the experience of victims in the criminal justice system. So I would like to thank the Right Honourable Member for Chesham and Amersham. I'd also like to thank her constituent for raising important issues that affect our criminal justice system today.